I'm Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, Scott.
My home group is the Clover Group in Warrenton, Virginia, and we meet on Tuesdays and Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Tuesdays are a step or tradition meeting, and Saturdays are a discussion or speaker meeting. And I see out in the audience that there are people that have attended the Clover Group, so come on down. We'd love to have you. Clover Group has been instrumental in my sobriety, and where the first meeting I attended, and it's the best home group in the state of Virginia, if not in Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And I know you have differing opinions of that. So I was talking to about speaking here, and I always get in uncomfortable speaking, and I used to think it was because we don't have enough speakers meetings, and then I came to realize, no, I just get uncomfortable speaking and telling my story. And I had heard a speaker one time say there, you know, when you get up to tell your story, you actually tell three stories, or there's three stories. You know, there's a story you're going to give, you know, what's going on in the squirrel cage before you stand up to the podium. And then there's the story you tell. And then on the way back home, I'll be talking with Don about the story I should have told. So we'll see if we can get close to all three of those. Little bit about what it was like, what it was like and what it's like now. I was born in a Midwest city, middle-class city, the name of it's Joliet, Illinois. As far as I know, I was not exposed to alcoholism while I was growing up. My father and mother were wonderful people. They did what they could with us. My father and mother divorced when I was about in second grade. I don't remember that being significant in my life, but as far as I know, my childhood and my life was as normal as could be. You know, the typical house with a white picket fence and a car in the garage and those kinds of things. Like I said, I don't remember being exposed to alcoholism. Sometime after I got sober, my aunt and my mother's sister, my aunt, revealed to me that actually my great-grandmother was the national vice president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And that she, in fact, had two or three brothers that were raging alcoholics. So if alcoholism is genetic, it skipped a couple generations before it got to me, and that's okay. I consider I came to do my alcoholism just naturally, you know. And my childhood was, like I said, is about as normal as I can imagine. I don't remember any alcoholism, no big drama or problems in my childhood. I was active in sports. I had friends. I, you know, played like a normal child, had friends like a normal child, went to school, didn't get in a lot of trouble, those kind of things. But somewhere around adolescence, and that's about seventh or eighth grade, it became very clear to me then, as it is now, that something switched inside of me. And I, you know, our big book describes it as, you know, we never felt like we quite fit in. And that's how I began to feel in junior high school, seventh or eighth grade. And I didn't quite believe I fit in. And the friendship started to go. I started to become somewhat of a loner. Doing things on my own, became very rebellious, very defiant, very antisocial, if you would hear my family describe it. And before I ever picked up a drink, I started with that behavior that many of us can relate to. In my freshman year in high school, rather than go to school one day, I left the house in the morning and proceeded to walk downtown, hop on a train, and run away. And I took a train to where my mother was living, which happened to be in Chicago, and just showed up at her door unannounced and said, I'm here to live with you. And thank goodness I had loving and caring parents, because she made the phone call to my father and let him know where I was, and my behavior and my rebellion and my defiance were even at such a point at that time that he went, okay, he can stay there. And I stayed there for about a year. And it was in that year that I probably got exposed to my first brush with alcoholism, and that was my stepfather. And my stepfather was a binge drinker. And he was a nice guy. I loved talking with him and palling around with him. And I don't know as if I looked up to him as a father figure, but I did respect the man. And he was the type of alcoholic that would work very hard for a given period of time, 6 months, a year, and then something would click inside of him. And he would announce that he was going to drink, and he would quit his job and drink for a week and a half, solid, to almost 24 hours a day, to the point that he got sick, physically sick, and then he'd stop and be sick for 2 or 3 days, and then get up and go look for a job and do it all over again. And it was during one of those binges that he was on that he was out and came back. And we talk about the personality change, the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality change in us. When he wasn't drinking, he was a nice guy. When he was drinking, he was violent. And he happened to come home drinking after drinking one night, and I have no idea what time or of the night or early morning it was, but we got into a physical altercation, and I ended up in the hospital for about a week, recovering from the effects of a physical altercation with about a 14-year-old man and about a 14-year-old boy and a 40-year-old man. And I saw him repeat that process a couple other times, although I did stay away from confronting him or engaging with him when he was drinking. And after about a year of that, along with some other things, I moved back home to my father and stepmother and family that they were beginning to start with his second marriage, my father's second marriage. Nothing had changed for me, though. I was still defiant and rebellious and somewhat of a loner, and rather than party or find the group that partied and drank, I found my first escape, and that escape happened to be work. And what I did is from about and up to this day, I was about 14, 15 years old, I started working full-time. And I would work full-time and go to school. Well, that meant there was no more time for sports. That meant there was no more time for friends. That meant there was no more time for family. I was just kind of off on my own. And whenever I would get together or be together with my family, I was such an angry young adult or angry teenager that you know, my parents and my brothers and sisters really didn't want to have anything to do with me. So it kind of left me to my own devices. I picked up probably my first drunk. That's what I'll talk about is my first drunk, because I don't know if I drank before that. If I did, there wasn't anything significant about it. But my first drunk happened to be, I was working at a restaurant, and happened to be after it closed at night, about 1 or 2 in the morning when the bar closes and the restaurant closes and everybody starts going home. Somebody I was working with, a friend, I guess, an acquaintance at a minimum, and I stole some beer out of the refrigerator in the restaurant, and we proceeded to drink that beer on the way home. I obviously, you know, I didn't get the effects of feeling 10 foot tall and bulletproof from drinking. I did have the feeling that I was a little more jovial. I was a little more social. I was a little funnier from drinking. And of course, being seeing as we stole the alcohol, we had to drink all of it. And I went home and went to bed. And I obviously was not as quiet getting into the house and feeling the effects of alcohol as I thought I was. Because early the next morning, I remember distinctly my father waking me up and saying, if you're going to drink like a man, you're going to work like a man. And it just so happened it was summertime, and we were putting a new roof on our garage in about 100-degree summer heat. So you can imagine what my day went like, you know, carry a bundle of shingles up to the roof, throw up, go back down. You know, that's kind of how my day went that day. I think my dad was trying to teach me a lesson, but the lesson he was trying to teach me and the lesson I learned are two different things. You know, I think he was trying to teach me that there are consequences for drinking. What I learned was if you work hard, you can play hard too. And that lesson stayed with me for a long, long time. The other significant, if I would call it that, bout with alcohol during my high school days was going to a party with my future ex-wife. I had gotten procured, you know, some of that great wine that we drink in early drinking days, you know, Boone's Farm, you know, the stuff that's never seen a grape. And I bought like 4 or 5 bottles of that at whatever price it was, probably less than $1 a bottle at that time. And for my wife and I to go to this party, for some reason she couldn't show up. And once again, you know, I just couldn't leave it. So I drank all that alcohol, all that wine. Needless to say, I was a little bit sick the next day. And the color of my vomit was not pretty. And I swore off, you know, it's my first solemn oath. I swore off wine, and it was something I never drank again or didn't drink again for another 20-some years until I met another woman. And so that's what my drinking was like in high school, and it's probably all you need to know about my drinking, but it just kind of continued on for years and years and years and years. In my senior year in high school, I knew that once I graduated from high school, I would no longer be welcome in my house, that my graduation gift would be luggage and it would be packed. So I made one of those decisions to join the Army, join the service. And I was 17 years old, and my father gladly signed those papers to allow me into the service. So I'm 17 years old, and I'm in basic training and the first my first schooling after basic training. I'm underage, and I am already a fledgling alcoholic. Every spare moment that I had where I didn't have any responsibilities or didn't have any place to show up or didn't have to look good, I was drinking. If you would have asked me at that time, I would have told you that I was just doing what everybody else did. I can look back on it today and realize that, you know, that was my rationalization and justification, because not everybody drank like me. Not even during that time, and I was underage at the time. I was not a good student in high school. I just barely graduated, probably a lot of it having to do with my focus was elsewhere, and that was work and women and fast cars when I could drive them. But I did graduate high school. What I discovered in my first class, my first schooling after basic training in the Army, was that I really could do fairly well academically if I put myself to it. And I had put myself to it, and I ended up graduating as the number one student in that class. And at that time, what came with graduating at the top of your class in that environment, what came with that was a promotion. And so my last day of school, I got my diploma or certificate, if you so desire. I got my certificate with, you know, the honor student and things like that. And class got out about 10 o'clock in the morning. Our formation, our gathering to for the end of the day and to recognize those people that had special recognition and things like this upcoming promotion, was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I proceeded after class to graduate to go out and celebrate my upcoming promotion. Unfortunately, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was so drunk I could hardly stand up. And your end-of-day formations in the service are a stand-up affair. And I'm standing up there and weaving and probably smelling like what I'd been drinking. And my company commander just took one look at me and called me out of the formation and said, "Why don't you go to my office and wait for me?" After the formation, I went in. He came into his office. I proceeded to get probably my first formal dressing down, not by no means my last, my first formal dressing down in the service. And he told me he couldn't uphold my promotion. He couldn't not give me that promotion, but he said, "I may be one hell of a student, but I'm a lousy soldier." And he wrote that on my promotion orders. And I still have those orders today. I don't know if it was a conscious effort or just an internal drive, but I went about for about the next 22 years to prove that man wrong. That I could be a good soldier, that I could be a good academic, and that I could drink how I wanted. And so it went, and so it goes pretty much throughout the year. So one of the things about a military career, and I spent 22 years in the Army, one of the things about a military career is that we have a built-in geographic, you know. Every 2 or 3 years, when my behavior and my drinking and my attitude and my general presence got too much for people to handle, I would move. And the clock would restart, and I would do that kind of all over again. It's not that I didn't have bouts of almost getting in trouble. I had plenty of those. And I had bouts of relative responsibility and relative adult behavior. My first duty tour was in Okinawa, Japan, and you know, I learned some valuable lessons in Okinawa, Japan. I learned how to find the red light districts. I learned how to drink and drink till the bars closed and then go back into the bar after they officially close and drink all night. I learned how to drink most of the night, if not all night, go back to the garrison or the base, get some breakfast, and go to work the next day. I learned to isolate myself from my fellows and to be a loner. I also learned, continued to learn, that lesson of work hard, play hard. Because if you put me in a work environment, everybody thought, you know, that I was the person to lead them in our work efforts. And if you saw me off duty and drinking, you would want to have nothing to do with me. I didn't have any bouts of trouble in my first tour, and my second tour happened to be in Texas, Fort Hood, Texas, and I married that high school sweetheart that is going to be my first ex-wife, and we had a child together, and I had responsibilities of being a father and a husband. And although when I drank to excess, they were just very, very few and far between episodes. And I have come to realize through the program Alcoholics Anonymous and things like the fourth and fifth step that is just part of my being. That given responsibility, given something to do, giving a task to accomplish, I can accomplish that and accomplish it well, but leave me to my own devices and just me, and I'm off to the races and drinking as much as I can for as long as I can. And I kept those two lives separate for quite a while. After Fort Hood, Texas, I went to Korea, which was an unaccompanied tour. That means my wife and son didn't come with me. My son was about 6 months old. And the best I can say about that tour is that I forgot I was married. I forgot I had a son. I forgot that I had responsibilities, not only emotionally, but financially and physically with my family. And I pretended I was single in Korea for the year I was there. And at the end of Korea, I had drank for so much for so long that when I was taking my exit physical from that country, that they took a one look at my blood work and one look at my physical condition and confined me for a week without being able to go downtown or go anywhere. I was basically confined to the barracks just to get all my physical aspects back under control. I was in no shape to leave Korea. And I came back, and my second tour in Texas, different city, San Antonio, and my daughter was born. And much like my first tour in Texas with my wife, I was responsible. I was a father and a husband. We bought a house, all those things, and there were no major incidents with my alcoholism because it hadn't gotten bad enough yet. Went back to Okinawa after San Antonio, Texas, and things start collapsing upon themselves. I can no longer keep these two separate lives, this responsible life as a husband and as a father, and in the irresponsible life as a hard-charging, hard-partying soldier. And I'm over there for 3 years, and the drinking starts to accelerate. And I start having... start becoming a father and a husband in name only, even though they are physically there with me. I'm working all the time, drinking when I'm not working most of the time. End up with a sexual harassment complaint because I ended up having an affair with somebody that worked for me. Not a good idea. Being the responsible soldier that I thought I was, I gave her an evaluation that I thought she deserved. She thought she might need something a little accelerated because I was sleeping with her. We did not see eye to eye on that. And I ended up with my second major dressing down. And it was truly just a dressing down. Because I was still in this career mode of, if you looked at my work life and my career life, I was, to quote out of some of my evaluations, I was the epitome of a soldier. I looked the part, I acted the part, I worked the part, but it wasn't a complete picture. It wasn't the complete picture of me because there was this whole other life. But because of that epitome of a soldier type label, the colonel of the installation, the commander of the installation, just gave me a dressing down for something that I could have been court-martialed for and thrown out of the Army. So up until this point... in my career, I'm receiving accelerated promotions, decorations, awards, you name it, kinds of things. And like I said, from the outside, if you looked at me from the outside, I had everything together. I was also accused of, at that time in my career, I had refound sports, and I was playing competitive softball for the Army. I had the accusation of being in the Army on a sports scholarship at one time because I was flying all over the Far East to play softball at the time. And so we left that place, and I had gotten another promotion, and this promotion happened to be one where only... two people in the Army in my career field got promoted. I was one of them. Because of that promotion and all those awards and decorations and things like that, I was selected to attend a for lack of a better term, an internship at Fort Meade, Maryland, where I was exposed and involved with some things that very, very few people ever get to experience. It was a lot of many high responsibility, high visibility, high interaction with some U.S. and foreign dignitaries kind of position. And one thing I learned there about drinking and alcoholism is, it doesn't matter what the alcohol is or what kind of glass it goes in, whether it goes in a plastic cup or a crystal cup. there are alcoholics all over this world, and there are people that drank like me in those environments. That is not what I was raised. You know, it's not the environment I raised with, but it was the environment I was in because of my position. And just like drinking in the service or drinking with my friend in high school, my acquaintance in high school, I gravitated towards those people that drank just like me, and it didn't matter. And by this time, I'm in Fort Meade, Maryland, and I'm in this internship, for a lack of a better term. It's very intense. I'm spending more and more time away from home, more and more time drinking. We used to have a regular Friday night get-together, happy hour, although we didn't call it that. Out of the Pentagon, we would go over to Crystal City, and I wouldn't get home until Saturday morning, those kinds of things. And I graduate from this internship, and because of that internship and that visibility and that accolades that I received out of that, I was selected for another promotion, another set of schooling, and I went away to that, and it was another version of basic training, or the U.S. military, West Point U.S. Military Academy. They took the worst of those two environments, put it into one, and said, "Scott, go to that." And I came out of that course as the number one student also, but the point is I came out of that, returned home after 6 to 8 weeks gone, and opened my house door, quarters door, on base, and walked in, and my house was empty. My wife had had enough. She'd had enough, and she had taken herself and the kids and had moved away and left. And I had more schooling to go to, and I went to that schooling, and I finished that schooling, and I finished that schooling number one. And ended up in Germany. And in Germany, I discovered the great joys of German beer. And pretty much repeated all that irresponsible behavior that I had learned so far in that career. Except at this point, I started drinking every night. And I would come home after 12, 14 hours of work, and drink myself into oblivion every night. But I wasn't going anywhere anymore. I was just sitting in my quarters, just drinking myself into oblivion. And I did that for near about 2 years. Came back and became involved in a very long and contentious divorce settlement, and child custody battle. And at the end of that battle, I got custody of the kids, and 2 weeks after I got custody of the kids, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and I was gone again. And came back for round two of custody battle. My drinking is way out of control now. I no longer cared. My drinking is beyond out of control, and my keen alcoholic mind, besides continuous drinking, thought it wouldn't be a bad idea to have an affair with your lawyer. And that, in retrospect, ought to have been quite hilarious, because there's me and the judge and my ex-wife and my lover all at the same table fighting over custody of my children. And I got custody of my children back, and proceeded over the next couple of years to drink them both back to their mother. And then it really starts spiraling downhill. I eventually end up with a DUI. A DUI in the military is a curse of death. It means that your career is over with, and so mine was. And because of my DUI, the Army, of course, sent me to their vision, a version of VASAP, and I'm in that, and thinking, you know, I just had bad luck. I just came out of the officers' club one night, you know, had a little bit too much to drink, and wrapped my car around a tree. It happens to the best of us, you know. It's not the end of the world. But I had to go to that VASAP, and the reason I mention that is somewhere in the process of doing that, the Army's version of ASAP, the counselor, who I found out later was a member of good standing of Al-Anon, gave me a where and when, which I proceeded to file away and not pay any attention to. About a year and a half after my DUI, I'm at the place that our big book calls the jumping off place. I couldn't imagine life with alcohol or without alcohol. And thank goodness that counselor had given me that where and when, because I'm not a pack rat and I throw things away. But I got desperate enough, and I have no idea what moved me to do it, but I got—I found that where and when, and I called an AA hotline. I called the wrong AA hotline, but I called an AA hotline, and thank goodness there was somebody in service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank goodness there was somebody at the end of that phone to talk to me, because the moment before I placed that phone call, I was sitting in my lounge chair with a beer in one hand and a 9mm in the other and not knowing what to do. And what that individual did, I don't know what he said, but I assume what he did was give me enough hope to make it one more night without doing what I was thinking of doing. And I ended up in the Clover Group the following Tuesday night. And I would love to tell you that that's how my sobriety started. But it's not how my sobriety started. About the only thing I did, or a couple things I did halfway decently or right when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, was I kept coming back, and I got in service. I didn't know it was called service then, but I was making coffee and setting up the meeting place, the Clover Group, every Tuesday and Thursday. Notice I didn't say I stopped drinking. I would show up to meetings before meetings. I would show up to meetings drinking. I would show up to meetings drunk. I would show up to meetings, you know, pretty much in the bag. As sometime after I got sober, people said, "Yes, Scott, we knew you were drinking. We used to sit next to you to get a whiff of original thinking." But I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And it took about 6 months, but eventually the program and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous started working in my life. What I remember starting working in my life, when it started working in my life, was after an especially brutal weekend, and this man came up to me and asked me how I was feeling. And I told him how I was feeling. I told him I was feeling like shit. And he said, "You know what? If you're drinking, you should feel that way. Here's my number. Give me a call someday." And I started calling that man. I called that man every day. Not that we had deep, meaningful conversations, but I would call him. Instead of cracking that first beer when I got home from work, I would call him. And I would say, "Jim, this is Scott. I'm going to such and such meeting tonight. And I was so scared that that he would show up to that meeting and I wouldn't be there, that I would go to that meeting. And just by virtue of doing that, I ended up getting sober and staying sober one day at a time. My history that 6 months was so tenuous of trying to not drink one day at a time that I really didn't know when my anniversary was. And I think it is June 10th, 1995. But it could have been the 3rd, it could have been the 10th. I just know that after some period, I went, you know what? I haven't had a drink in 30 days. When was that? And just backtracking. So I picked June 10th as my anniversary date. The man that was my first sponsor saved my life, took me through the steps. I did my 4th and 5th step about 6 months into sobriety, only out of fear. And it was fear because I was going back to Korea on a business trip, and I knew what I had done in Korea the first time, and I was willing to do anything not to drink in that country again. So I did my 4th and 5th step. We went through the steps together. Somewhere along the line, that man suggested I start calling another man because we might have a lot in common. And I started calling this other man. His name's Mike. And God moves in mysterious ways. As we developed our relationship together, we started talking, and we realized that we had drank with some of the same people. We had hung out with some of the same people. We were in the first Gulf War together in the same unit and didn't know each other. And he was my sponsor for a long, long time. That sponsor, Mike, when I started calling him and we started this relationship, he was our alternate GSR in the Clover Group. He became GSR because our GSR got drunk. Guess who became the alternate GSR? So, you know, Mike rotated on, became the alternate DCM and DCM for the district. I was the GSR, but when Mike became DCM for the district, guess who became alternate DCM? And so my service journey began. And I began a journey of attending assemblies and gatherings of the GSRs in the Commonwealth of Virginia, Area 71. And I found out I liked it. You know, I know some people say that's all politics and it's all fighting and all that. I found it very, very interesting and very democratic. And I got interested in how Alcoholics Anonymous runs and what makes us tick and what makes us do what we do, not only in our home groups, but to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide. And I got interested, and I started participating in that and started sharing in that. Eventually I rotated out of DCM and got asked to serve as a special assignment coordinator, mailing list coordinator for the Virginia area, and a different aspect of my sobriety and my service journey began, and I got very involved in general service to Alcoholics Anonymous, or general service with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I won't bore you with all the positions I held. Just sufficient to say that I continued a service journey up until October of 2012, you elected me to serve as your delegate to the General Service Conference. So, yeah, I avoided the 8th and 9th step because I didn't want to cry here tonight. Don knows me. So I'm going to cry, so I'm going to say it anyway. Of all the honors and all the accolades and all the medals and all the promotions that I received in a military career, being asked to serve 25,000 drunks in the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, Area 71, is probably one of the highest honors that I have ever received, because it comes from peers. It comes from drunks just like me, asking that somebody that didn't know whether he wanted to live or die to ask me to represent you at the General Service Conference, and I thank you for that. So since I'm emotional, and I always try and avoid it but never do, I want to go back to the program Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you some of the benefits that I've received. And it all, most of it revolves around the 8th and 9th step. I had drank my children out of the house, both of them, to the point that they did not want to have anything to do with me. They were willing to put up with some of the behavior, some of the revolving girlfriends and things like that that we had when I was single. But they couldn't excuse my behavior toward them, and they went back to their mother. And I'm in the Clover Group on my 4th anniversary, and I've done the best I can to live and work the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And my daughter is in that meeting, and she thanks you guys for giving her father back. She didn't thank me. She thanked you guys in the program Alcoholics Anonymous for giving her father back. I'm making my 9th step amends to my mother. And my mother was a person that probably had a handful of drinks in her whole life. You know, and I'm doing what I can in my 9th step with her. And she goes, "Scott, I have no idea about this no drinking thing, but whatever you're doing, keep doing, because I like the person you are and you're becoming." That tells me that the program Alcoholics Anonymous can change our lives. It has for me. I am not the person, I am not the angry person that came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Most recently, my father celebrated his 80th birthday, and I went back to my hometown in Joliet, Illinois, to celebrate that occasion with him and my siblings, who I hadn't seen in 15 years. The siblings that I had not been a good brother to, the parents that I had not been a good son to. At a minimum, I was absentee in both occasions. And they asked me to give the toast for my father. It's an honor. It's one of those honors that you think you have destroyed everything worthwhile in your life, and the program Alcoholics Anonymous has given it back to me. I came to you a pretty broken person. I didn't know whether I wanted to live or die. Through the process of sponsorship, through the process of the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and through the processes of recovery and unity and service, you've restored me. I didn't know how to love, and you've showed me how to love. I didn't know how to be a worker among workers, and you showed me how to do that. I didn't know how to feel comfortable in my own skin, and today, most days, I am. It's nothing I've done. It's something that was laid out for us in 1939, and I like to close with just a little bit out of that, if I may, because it means so much to me, And I have heard others say it means a lot to them. And it's off of page 164 of the big book. And it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.